Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, NHK Japan, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Excerpts from an interview with Stephen Walt, who's a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. He recently published an article called "The United States Has Become a Rogue State." He says that the war on Iran shows the limits of American power, and it raises doubts about the current American foreign policy leadership. He defines a rogue state as one that is a threat to international peace. The U.S. is viewed by its allies as impulsive and predatory, who now see China as a more responsible player in world affairs. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
Well, beyond the immediate diplomacy, the bigger question is what this conflict reveals about the limits of American power and strategy. I want to bring in now Stephen Walt. He's a professor of international affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School. I know you recently published an article in Foreign Policy called "The United States Has Become a Rogue State. Here's What the Rest of the World Can Do About It." And in that you write, the United States is still very powerful, even if it is now pursuing policies that will weaken it over time. So with that in mind, how much does this war with Iran illustrate that point?
Well, I think the more than anything else, the war with Iran reveals, first of all, the limits of American military power. We can blow lots of things up, but we can't necessarily dictate political outcomes. But second of all, it raises real doubts about the competence of the American foreign policy leadership right now. And American influence is based in part on others trusting our judgment, thinking that American officials know what they're doing. And this war looks like something that was ill-planned and has basically been improvised from the very beginning. That doesn't increase confidence in American judgment.
It was well noted by media around the world that the recent talks in Islamabad were comprised of an Iranian foreign minister with a PhD. The other members of the delegation were all seasoned veterans of government and security. On the other side, for the United States, you had the vice president, you had a real estate billionaire, and you had Trump's son-in-law. So are we seeing here structural limits of power, or are we seeing here just simple poor decision making?
Well, there's clearly the latter, that, you know, this is amateur hour diplomacy, and it's not surprising that the talks before the war didn't go anywhere, and it's not surprising that the talks in Islamabad were a complete failure. You can't solve a problem like this in 24 hours with amateurs. But more importantly, the planning for the war itself was a haphazard. No one seemed to take seriously the possibility that Iran might actually close the Strait of Hormuz, even though they'd been preparing to do that for a long time and saying that's what they would do if they were attacked.
It's more than just amateur hour here, right? You argue that the United States is now behaving like a rogue state. I mean, what does that mean in practice in a conflict like we're seeing right now with Iran?
Well, a rogue state traditionally is thought of, first of all, as a state that's a threat to international peace and security. And by starting this war, which affects countries all over the world for economic reasons, the United States has threatened all of their interests. We've also shown a remarkable indifference to international norms and international law. It's an illegal war. We've also assassinated the civilian leadership of Iran quite deliberately, thereby destroying a longstanding norm that governments didn't try to kill each other's leaders for all the practical reasons involved. So in a sense, the United States is acting like the kind of behavior we used to expect from countries like North Korea or Iraq or Libya under Gaddafi, and that can't be good for American influence over the longer term. I think the United States is now being viewed by others as impulsive and erratic and predatory. The impulsiveness is obvious, the way we keep shifting our goals. But the predatory part is really a shift in American foreign policy, where we're not just trying to take advantage of adversaries, but we're also trying to take advantage of allies at every turn. And I think that's the other theme that allies around the world are starting to incorporate, that the United States is not predictable and often actually quite hostile to them.
These allies, are you talking about NATO members and the European Union, for example?
Absolutely. But not just those allies. I mean, first of all, the tariff policy that they've pursued deliberately attempts to harm other economies, force them to make concessions to the United States, something we have traditionally not done towards our allies. And second, when the administration says it wants to take over Greenland, something the president keeps repeating, even in the last couple of days, that's a sign of predation as well, of wanting to take things that don't belong to you.
You know, in your article, Stephen, you lay out different strategies for dealing with the U.S., from balancing to de-risking. Which of those do you think countries are actually adopting in response to this war?
Well, the most obvious one, of course, is de-risking, which you see other countries trying to find new trade partners, trying to move away from fossil fuels, something the United States is not doing. Everyone is understanding what the implications of this are. We've also seen, countries like Spain and Italy distance themselves to some degree from the United States because they don't want to be associated with an impulsive and failed war. And finally, we're seeing countries, I think, looking now towards China as a more responsible player in world affairs, as a country that isn't constantly attacking others, isn't constantly disrupting the world economy in quite the same way.
I know that you have been quoted as saying that Donald Trump's USA is a predatory hegemon. You know as well as I do that Donald Trump will most likely be history after 2028. What could give hope that once he is gone, the benevolent hegemon USA will return?
I think that it's going to be harder to rebuild trust in the United States, given that we elected Trump not once, but twice. But one of the things one can do is, first of all, stop listening to the people who got us here. And that involves some house cleaning in the American foreign policy establishment. And it also means holding the officials who were responsible for some of these errors accountable. If the rest of the world sees the United States actually, say, punishing former officials, not for policy disagreements, but in cases where they might have broken the law, for example, that's a sign that we realize that we screwed up, and therefore others might have more confidence that we'll learn from this mistake and do better in the future.
Even if Donald Trump is an anomaly, do you think our allies will be able to forgive and forget?
I think that in the past, at least, when the United States has elected new officials, our image in the world has tended to rebound. So the American image was pretty low at the end of the Bush presidency. It soared as soon as we elected Barack Obama. The same thing happened when, Joe Biden was elected after Trump's first term. So I think there's some possibility of a recovery, particularly if an incoming administration says the right things and stops acting in such a predatory fashion.
Professor Stephen Watt, very good discussion. We appreciate you taking the time to put all of this into context for us and for offering a little bit of a silver lining as well. Thank you.
That excerpted analysis was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. This entire interview, called "Has the United States Become a Rogue State?", is available online and highly recommended. DW is also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, France 24. In London, thousands of people protested the arrest of 1,500 on charges of terrorism for carrying signs supporting the group Palestine Action. This past weekend, another 523 were charged with terrorism for carrying signs. In France, a draft bill called the Yandi Bill would make any statement opposing the state of Israel a crime of anti-Semitism. That bill's being heard in Parliament. More than 2,100 Lebanese, including 168 children, have been killed by Israeli forces in the past 6 weeks. Ukraine is using robot attack vehicles in the war with Russia. France 24.
Armed with pens, paper, and a lot of patience, thousands of activists staged a sit-down protest in support of Palestine Action, a group banned in July 2025 under the Terrorism Act.
The situation we have at the moment is absurd. I think it was absurd when they arrested the people before. We've got a 1,000% rise in the number of terrorists in this country just based on old people being arrested for holding a sign.
It was the first mass demonstration opposing the prescription of Palestine Action since the ban was ruled unlawful by the High Court in February. Despite the ruling, the ban has remained in place pending an appeal from the UK government.
But the proscription of Palestine Action was illegal, was always illegal. So it's absolutely insane that the police are still planning to arrest people.
According to the Metropolitan Police, 523 people were arrested for showing support for proscribed organisation.
Well, hopefully if the government appeal is turned down, then all of this will be a complete waste of police time.
Are you sure? Because we're going to have to carry you quite a while.
Well, that's up to you.
Here we go.
More than 2,200 people have been arrested since Palestine Action was banned, but hundreds of trials have been put on hold while the legal battle over the ban continues.
Dozens of demonstrators gather near Paris's National Assembly. They are protesting France's Yadon Bill, which has the stated aim of fighting anti-Semitism. Those opposed to the legislation, which include left-wing lawmakers and human rights groups, say it endangers free speech.
By saying that Netanyahu is committing genocide, that he's a war criminal and that he must be punished for it, we're not being anti-Semitic, we're defending international law and humanity.
The draft bill, under discussion by lawmakers on Thursday, proposes to sanction implicit incitement to or justification of terrorism, along with calls for the destruction of a state recognized by France and comparisons of Israel to the Nazi regime. Critics argue the text conflates the Jewish community with Israel, which they say would stifle criticism of the Jewish state. However, Caroline Yadon, the French MP proposing the law, defends it as a tool to fight new forms of anti-Semitism, which has seen a historic rise in France.
I am deeply committed to freedom of expression, and there was no question of my undermining that. I truly dedicate myself to the fight against anti-Semitism in France.
These arguments were not convincing to the over 700,000 people who signed a petition opposing the bill. The petition, originally posted to the National Assembly's website, will not be debated by lawmakers after a commission voted to dismiss it. In France, anti-Semitic attacks soared following the Hamas attack on October 7, 2023, and the beginning of the war in Gaza. In 2025, the French Interior Ministry recorded 1,320 anti-Semitic attacks.
As strikes continue, southern Lebanon is bearing the brunt of the violence. As recently as Wednesday morning, Israeli strikes hit a vehicle 20 kilometers south of Beirut. Israeli attacks across the south are leaving behind utter destruction, destroying homes and killing children. 11-year-old Jawad Jones and his cousins were playing football in a lot near their homes when an Israeli strike hit, killing him and his cousin. Several other children were wounded.
This is very hard on me. My son was just out playing. How can he be here now? I can't see him anymore. I can't look into his beautiful eyes. I have no words anymore.
Jawad and his cousin are among more than 2,100 people in Lebanon killed by Israeli strikes in 6 weeks, 168 of whom were children. Reconstructive surgeon Dr. Ghassan Abu Sita runs an initiative treating some of the most seriously war-wounded children.
In this war, Israel is directly targeting people's homes, and so we're getting a lot of shrapnel injuries, a lot of direct blast wounds, rubble, children being crushed underneath the rubble of their own homes.
The Israeli military has not denied that children have been killed in these airstrikes, yet insist they are targeting Hezbollah facilities and militants.
Next, Emily is going to take us to Ukraine. A new form of warfare seems to be developing there, Emily.
Yes, and quite a worrying one too. This is a report in Foreign Policy this morning here. It talks about the state in Ukraine. The pressure of the Russian drone warfare has led to Ukraine turning to a new kind of super soldier, specifically robots. Now, for the moment, they're not quite Terminator standards. They look more like a four-wheeled platform equipped with guns and Starlink terminals, so operators can stay out of drone distance and drive them from a distance as well. Now, up until recently, those were mainly used for supplying the front line with equipment, for example, or evacuating wounded soldiers. But now these machines have taken a new step. Let's have a look in Politico. For the first time in history, robots have managed to capture Russian army positions and even managed to force Russian soldiers to surrender. Now, according to Volodymyr Zelensky, these robots have performed more than 22,000 missions on Ukrainian front lines in the first 3 months of 2026 alone.
Those reports and press review are from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. Also, most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, NHK Japan. Non-governmental organizations and a group of atomic bomb survivors are asking the Japanese government to lead the charge on the upcoming nuclear non-proliferation treaty in New York, the end of this month. This week marked 3 years of deadly war between the military and paramilitary in Sudan. Over 59,000 have died. NHK Japan.
A group of atomic bomb survivors and NGOs are calling on the Japanese government to lead the charge on nuclear non-proliferation. The advocates submitted a written request to Japan's foreign ministry on Tuesday. It calls on the country to promote the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons ahead of an upcoming review conference in New York. Members of the Nobel Peace Prize-winning organization Nihon Hidankyo and NGOs visited the ministry with their letter. In it, they say Japan should urge all treaty members to meet their disarmament obligations. A foreign ministry official responded that strengthening the non-proliferation framework is even more essential given current global tensions. Nihon Hidankyo co-chair Tanaka Teremi later told reporters that while the ministry agreed on some points, its response fell short of its expectations.
As we are the only nation to have suffered atomic bombings in wartime, we have a big role to play, especially during these difficult times. Unfortunately, I did not sense that kind of resolve from the government.
The review conference is scheduled to begin in late April at the UN headquarters. The previous two meetings failed to adopt a final document. Wednesday marks 3 years since fighting broke out in Sudan between the nation's military and the paramilitary. The humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate, with at least 59,000 people reported dead. In April 2023, a dispute over military restructuring led to an armed conflict between the Sudanese Army and Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. Clashes spread across the country. According to the United Nations, about 11.6 million people have been forced to flee their homes. It's calling this one of the world's largest humanitarian crises. Since the army recaptured the capital, Khartoum, in March 1 year ago, many of the displaced have begun to return there. But rebuilding their lives is not easy. The city's infrastructure was severely damaged by the fighting, and many homes were rendered uninhabitable. Returnees say it's difficult to obtain construction materials needed to rebuild and report that fuel prices have risen due to the situation in Iran.
We are still saying there is fighting going on, and we are still saying there is fresh displacement. So, of course, the emergency humanitarian response still very much remains a priority.
The military and the RSF continue to fight intermittently.
A number of neighboring countries are reported to have also become involved in the conflict, with some even supplying arms.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. NHK may also be easily found at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this show, like listeners in Albion and Willits, California and Boulder City, Nevada did this week, my PayPal contact information is available at my website, outfarpress.com, or write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California 95490. I'm really grateful for the donations. They're essential for the weekly production and website fees for the show, which I supply without charge to more than 100 radio stations around the world. If you're listening on a public radio station, please support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. There were numerous large demonstrations of solidarity for Cuba in major cities in Europe last Saturday. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu revealed last week that J.D. Vance reports to him daily. In the West Bank, Israeli forces fired tear gas at Palestinian students having a school session outdoors. In New York City, 100 anti-war protesters led by Jewish Voice for Peace were arrested outside Chuck Schumer's office. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez expressed his gratitude yesterday, for the solidarity shown by friends, members of political and social organizations, and compatriots residing in Europe for the massive mobilizations held in support of Cuba. The head of Cuban diplomacy emphasized that these demonstrations of solidarity prove that the Caribbean nation is not alone in its struggle against what he said is the genocidal blockade and energy embargo and blockade imposed by Washington to suffocate the Cuban people. The protests held Saturday over the weekend took place in major cities such as Brussels, Paris, and Rome. In the Belgian capital, in Brussels, a united coalition of social movements and political leaders gathered in front of the U.S. Embassy to demand an end to unilateral coercive measures against Cuba. Meanwhile, in France, in Paris, the Eiffel Tower was the meeting point where various unions, such as the General Confederation of Labor, the CGT, and Solidarity Associations, reaffirmed their support for Cuba as an international symbol of justice and humanism. The largest mobilization took place in Italy, where more than 10,000 people marched through the streets of Rome under the slogan, "Cuba is not a threat." The National Solidarity Movement in Italy has prepared a container with medicines and essential supplies, which will soon depart for the island, intended to alleviate the consequences of the U.S. blockade. Iran's first vice president, Mohammad Reza Aref, says that the White House is not acting as an independent entity in its foreign policy and has devolved into a reporting branch for Israel. Aref made the remarks in a post on his X account on yesterday, one day after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance reported to him on the way back from Islamabad, as he does every day. The first vice president of Iran said, "For the first time in history, a senior official of a government is providing daily briefings to the head of another government. The issue is not us. It's a matter of structural humiliation. Do the American people realize that the White House has effectively turned into a reporting bureau for another regime?" News of the daily briefing sparked outrage across the political spectrum, some commentators saying that this meant that Israel was calling the shots, as the United States and Iran were negotiating to try to find a permanent solution to the war. The negotiations between Iran and the United States came to an end without striking any deal after 21 hours of discussions in the Pakistani capital of Islamabad. J.D. Vance, the vice president of the United States, in a very short news conference, said the United States had failed to reach an agreement with Iran after negotiations, and they gave it their best shot. Iranian officials said that Washington's excessive demands hampered an agreement right from the beginning in Pakistan. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces fired tear gas at Palestinian schoolchildren who were staging a sit-in protest earlier this week after settlers blocked access to their school in the village of Kalar in the Masafer Yatta region. The students had been peacefully holding an open-air class when they were gassed. They were seeking to return to classrooms for the first time in over 40 days after the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran forced schools across the West Bank to close. In New York City, nearly 100 anti-war protesters led by Jewish Voice for Peace were arrested outside the offices of Senate Democrats Chuck Schumer and Kristen Gillibrand while attempting to stage a sit-in. Demonstrators demanded the senators use their power to block a pending U.S. sale of thousands of bombs to Israel. Police moved in as the activists filled the sidewalks with signs and chants. Sonia Meyerson Cox of Jewish Voice for Peace had this to say. Our senators need to listen to their constituents. Right now, the United States is continuing to send endless amounts of money and weapons to Israel. As it does that, it is bombing Beirut. It is occupying South Lebanon. It bombs synagogues and universities in Iran. And it is continuing its genocide in Gaza. It is doing this with our weapons that we are sending and our money, our tax money, to Israel to buy these weapons. So our senators need to listen to their constituents. 300 New Yorkers are here to say, stop arming Israel. The U.S. military says it struck an alleged drug vessel in the Eastern Pacific on Monday, killing two people. The Pentagon offered no evidence whatsoever, because there is no evidence, that the boat was carrying drugs. This latest strike comes 2 days after U.S. military strikes killed five people in two boats, also in the Eastern Pacific. The attack brings the total death toll to at least 170 people since the Trump administration began targeting so-called narco-terrorists in little boats in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific last September, 6 months ago. International law, experts, and human rights groups say that the U.S. strikes are extrajudicial killings and against international law.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website's working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at 6000. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to work harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. Please consider subscribing. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 30th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. This month, the Shortwave Report is celebrating having been on the air for 30 years without a break. If you appreciate this weekly program, please support it. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.